Good evening, members of Congress. Read the Mueller report into the record. Chelsea Manning is back in jail and faces a big fine, while the community is divided by a plan to make Lower Manhattan resilient to climate change. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Friday, May 17th, 2019.
The president asked McGahn whether he would, quote, do a correction, unquote, and McGahn said no. McGahn thought the president was testing his mettle to see how committed McGahn was to what happened. Kelly described the meeting as a little tense. The president also asked McGahn in the meeting why he had told special counsel office investigators that the president had told him to have the special counsel removed. McGahn responded that he had to and that his conversations with the president were not protected by attorney-client privilege. The president then asked, quote, what about these notes? Why do you take notes? Lawyers don't take notes. I never had a lawyer who took notes. McGahn responded that he keeps notes because he is a real lawyer and explained that notes create a record and are not a bad thing. The president said, quote, I've had a lot of great lawyers like Roy Cohn. He did not take notes, unquote. After the Oval Office meeting concluded, Kelly recalled McGahn telling him that McGahn and the president, quote, did have that conversation, unquote, about removing the special counsel. McGahn recalled that Kelly said that he had pointed out to the president after the Oval Office that Mr. McGahn had not backed down and would not budge. Following the Oval Office meeting, the president's personal counsel called McGahn's counsel and relayed that the president was, quote, fine, unquote, with McGahn. Analysis. In analyzing the president's efforts to have McGahn deny that he had been ordered to have the special counsel removed, the following evidence is relevant to the elements of obstruction of justice. A, obstructive act. The president's repeated efforts to get McGahn to create a record denying the president had directed him to remove the special counsel would qualify as an obstructive act if it had the natural tendency to constrain McGahn from testifying truthfully or to undermine his credibility as a potential witness if he testified consistently with his memory rather than with what the record said.
Representative Jackie Speier of California, one of several representatives who read excerpts from the Mueller report into the House record on Friday. The marathon reading started yesterday and has been going on for more than 13 hours. Meanwhile, the full House voted to pass H.R. 5, a law to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex, gender identity, and sexual orientation, and for other purposes. Several House members spoke out in support of the bill.
Too many Americans face severe discrimination because of who they love. LGBTQ rights are civil rights, they're human rights. Participating and contributing equally, regardless of gender identity or sexual orientation, brings us closer to the self-evident truth that while we are not all created the same, in a just democracy, we are all created equally. Despite state Republican hostility, City of Austin ordinances have long protected against the same discrimination we are combating today. City contractors have complied with these ordinances, whose requirements set the standard for our community. Both Austin and San Antonio enjoy perfect municipal equality index scores from the Human Rights Campaign. With this bill, we set the same type of standard for our entire country. 1,400 businesses in Texas, in the Competes Coalition, have sent a clear message in favor of inclusion and against discrimination. We need strong federal enforcement.
Germinating for 5 years plus, I want to speak to my religious friends, that is all of us, claim a religion of some form. And I want to say to you that religious liberty is not dead, but it is alive. This bill focuses on saving lives. It focuses on understanding what it means to be transgender and denied the right to serve in the United States military. Or it stands up for African-American transgender women who have been killed in the South, in the region that I live in. And it stands up for the person who knocked on the door and could not get housing because of their status. And so I'd ask my friends who are Mormon, Seventh-day Adventists, who are Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and other religions, how would you feel if you knocked on a door and you could not get in? If they had no place for you at the inn? And so I'm well aware of the Restorative Act dealing with religion passed in 1993. But I'm also aware of the Supreme Court case, the Hodges case, in 2015 that said they asked for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right. That is what this bill is doing. And the Constitution will protect those who are involved in their religious practices. As it has indicated, we the people organized to form a more perfect union. And then you go to the Bill of Rights, and it has as the amendment number one, the Congress shall make no law respecting an individual's right of religion or the practice thereof. The Constitution will be alongside of the Equality Act, and we'll be able to have fair housing and civil rights, and we will be able to deal with this issue. It is important.
We heard powerful testimony from Kimberly, the mother of Kai, an 8-year-old transgender girl. Kimberly's an evangelical minister from rural Texas. Her family and Kai's school were not supportive, and in fact, school administrators made derogatory comments about Kai. Kimberly testified that regretfully she gave in to pressure and attempted home conversion therapy on Kai when Kai was only 4 years old. One day she found Kai praying for Jesus to take her home to be with him forever. Let me say that another way. A 4-year-old was suicidal. Kimberly is now today a fierce advocate for her daughter's rights and the rights of all transgender kids to go to school in a safe and supportive environment. This bill will secure that right for all the kids like Kai around the country and will secure the right to be free from discrimination for millions of LGBTQ people in our country. And I want to close with the words from federal judge Michael McShane in his marriage equality opinion. He wrote, "Many suggest we are going down a slippery slope that will have no moral boundaries. To those who truly harbor such fears, I can only say this. Let us look less to the sky to see what might fall. Let us look to each other and rise." I yield back.
The 236 to 173 vote sends the measure to the Senate, but leading Republicans predict it will cause catastrophic gender bending and gut religious exercises. Eight House Republicans voted for the bill known as H.R. 5. The Equality Act would expand the Civil Rights Act of 1964, along with a handful of other laws that collectively ban discrimination in housing, finances, employment, schools, and public places on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. If approved by the Republican-controlled Senate and signed into law, which appears unlikely, the measure would elevate LGBT rights to the same status as other classes protected from discrimination, such as race and national origin. And Chelsea Manning, who spent 7 years in prison for leaking evidence of United States war crimes, is back in jail for refusing to answer questions from a grand jury. She had been released last week after similar imprisonment, but a new grand jury and a new judge sent her back with a huge fine to boot. Del Cameron of Gizmodo has this.
Chelsea, the former U.S. Army intelligence analyst turned activist, got taken back into custody yesterday after being released about a week ago from the Virginia jail where she had been held for a little over 62 days. She was released last week because the federal grand jury that she refused to testify in front of about her association, her past association with WikiLeaks, that grand jury expired. She was released for about a week. Her attorneys were subpoenaed while she was still in jail, letting them know, we're going to call you back, call her back, and ask her the same questions. They knew potentially, this new judge that they're in front of would also just have her arrested if she didn't, testify.
There was more to it than just being arrested. There's a fine as well.
She is facing a daily fine. I can't remember the figure off the top of my head. I think it's something like $500, and I think it goes up to $1,000 after a certain number of days. That's kind of, I don't want to use the word unprecedented, but it's not normal. Normally, maybe companies, fines of that nature are applied to companies. So it is a little unusual, I think, for them to do that to a to a witness in front of a grand jury who isn't actually accused of breaking the law. Manning has committed contempt, which is a process crime. It's not really a crime per se. She's in jail technically, not because she's being punished for committing a crime, but because they're trying to coerce her into cooperating. So the minute she agrees to cooperate, she'd walk free. If the judge believed Manning would never talk no matter what, the judge would have to release her, at least if they had any regard for the spirit of the law. In addition, I think the time on incarcerating someone for this is about 18 months. Or if the grand jury they've called her to testify in front of this time gets dismissed, they'd have to release her in that case as well.
What exactly are they looking for?
Manning had limited interactions with WikiLeaks. She was only ever in communication with them through a chat room. They have all of those chat logs. They know exactly what was said. They have charged Assange with conspiracy to commit a computer crime. They say essentially that Manning said she was having trouble with a password and that Julian Assange, supposedly him, again, this is over a chat room. There's no way for just looking at a piece of paper to tell who was on the other side of the computer screen. But, you know, that WikiLeaks offered to help her crack a password, which was encrypted, scrambled. At that point in the conversation is where they say WikiLeaks stopped being, or Julian Assange stopped being a journalist and started being a conspirator. To give them any advice whatsoever that helps them commit a crime or helps them evade law enforcement, that would be typically what you would think of as a reporter as crossing the line and then actually becoming a participant in the crime itself. So that's what they're accusing Assange of doing. Manning has already served 7 years for her part in that crime, and her sentence was commuted by President Obama in one of his last acts in office. They can't charge her again for that, obviously. So, I mean, honestly, it's really just not clear what they want from her. Her lawyers basically are arguing that it's inappropriate to keep her in jail because grand juries are meant to serve an investigative function, and they say they're not intended to help the government prepare for a trial against someone who's already been indicted. And it seems that that's what they're doing. They're saying that that's an impermissible use of the grand jury process. So there may be a motion that these attorneys can file and get Manning out of jail. Assange has already been indicted, so maybe this grand jury is dismissed soon. The worst case scenario for her is that she sits there, but I think the time limit is 18 months. They could keep her in jail for 18 months.
I see.
And then she would have an enormous fine to pay when she got out as well.
Del Cameron of Gizmodo. And a new weapon in the fight to fully open the subways to the disabled is a federal lawsuit that would force the MTA to make every station and renovates accessible to riders in wheelchairs. Disability Rights Advocates, a national nonprofit, brought the legal challenge. Emboldened by a federal judge's ruling, the MTA violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by renovating a Bronx subway station without adding elevators. Emily Seelenfrund is the lead attorney in the suit, and she had this to say.
The lawsuit we filed Wednesday basically alleges that the MTA has been wholesale violating the part of the Americans with Disabilities Act that requires public entities, when they do renovations, to also, make that renovated area accessible to people with disabilities. And, for the last 20-plus years, the MTA has basically been ignoring that mandate in the ADA, and they've been renovating stations, and that includes rebuilding staircases, installing amenities like Wi-Fi, but not also doing work to make the station more usable for those who can't take stairs.
And what are the type of things that are necessary to make it more usable?
Our allegations focus on a stair-free path of travel. So that impacts all New Yorkers who struggle to take stairs, and that includes people with mobility disabilities, so those who use wheelchairs, walkers, canes, also people who have heart or lung conditions, and so those are the people who are legally protected, but obviously, as we know, elevators really benefit everyone, and they also benefit parents with strollers, they benefit the elderly, they benefit tourists. The potential implications for this lawsuit are wide-ranging.
What's the problem with New York with these elevators? They've been ignoring it, you said. What does that mean? I mean, there seems to be some elevators at some stations. Is it more required or are more necessary?
The law law is pretty clear that when the MTA does renovations of this scale, they do, in fact, have to also take into account the needs of their customers with disabilities. And, in fact, this case was filed as a related case to a lawsuit that disability rights advocates filed in 2016. And that was a case about a renovation up in the Bronx. And the MTA, again, did the similar scope of work. They closed the station for 6 months, and they didn't include accessibility. And a federal judge ruled just last month that the MTA violated the law by not considering access needs in that renovation. And there are some stations with elevators, but it's less than a quarter of subway stations. And the gaps between accessible stations are often miles apart, which basically means that there are some neighborhoods that are completely cut off from the subway if you can't take the stairs.
Now, I notice a lot of these elevators are out of service, and there were some complaints that they often, even the ones that are built, are out of service. Is that part of your lawsuit?
We have a separate lawsuit about the issue of elevator maintenance. And as you said, the MTA not only has a duty to, you know, build elevators when they do renovations, they also have a duty to maintain those elevators once they put them in. And they're also not complying with that mandate of the ADA. And that actually has some really bad implications for customers, because there's so few accessible stations. If an elevator breaks down, you're basically trapped in the system, and you might have to go miles out of your way just to exit the system. And it basically means you can't rely on the system at all, because you never know when you're going to get to the station and the elevator's not going to be working.
Is this a problem around the United States, not just in New York? Are other localities also facing the same problem?
You know, I think New York is unfortunately unique in this regard, at least somewhat. We are dead last in terms of subway accessibility, and it's not even a close race. New York is somewhere around 25% of accessible stations. Many major cities are at 100%. LA and San Francisco are 100%. DC is 100%. And other older cities like Chicago and Boston, which were cities where the transit systems were built before the ADA was passed, they're at around 70-75% of stations accessible, and many of those agencies have plans to get to 100% accessibility within the next 15 to 20 years. New York has not committed to such a plan.
Do you have
anywhere close?
Do you have any idea why this is? Why New York is so behind everybody else?
I don't know where their priorities lie, but it's just clear that they're not prioritizing this. And, you know, in other cities, you know, the heads of transit agencies have stepped up and said, we're going to make this a priority. One of the reasons Boston is so accessible, actually, is because there was a successful lawsuit and settlement agreement that resulted in a settlement that made the system substantially more accessible. So, you know, sometimes at the end of the day, you need, you know, plaintiffs who are willing to step up and vindicate their civil rights along with the civil rights of all New Yorkers with disabilities and just say, you know, we're not going to take this system the way it is, we're going to make a change.
Now, I notice people use AccessoRide and things like that. Is the city trying to push people towards just using AccessoRide or something like that?
There is AccessoRide. It's a vastly inferior system. It requires a 24-hour notice, advance notice for anywhere you want to go, as opposed to the subway, which is, you know, rapid and can be planned at the last minute. I think the city made a big mistake. I think when, you know, the ADA was passed, they invested a lot of money in AccessoRide as a way they thought that would perhaps, you know, make it so they didn't have to make as many stations accessible. So they were like, let's put a lot of money into AccessoRide. AccessoRide now costs $70 per ride. So they're basically sinking a ton of money into AccessoRide, and you still have a system that's substantially inaccessible. And if they had just kind of, you know, decided to make the initial investment, that investment would be paying off in the long run, because they wouldn't be sinking so much money into AccessoRide, which at the end of the day isn't benefiting everyone or anyone.
What happens next with this lawsuit?
The MTA will give us an answer within a month or so, and they'll basically confirm or deny these allegations, and then we will enter the discovery phase, so we'll get to learn a lot more factual information about the renovations at these stations and whether the MTA made any consideration about accessibility at the dozens of stations where we allege that the MTA shut the station down and made illegal renovations without including elevator access.
And that was Emily Seelenfreund, and she is the lead attorney for Disability Rights Advocates, which is seeking to have more elevators provided in New York City subway stations, and to increase the repairs of those elevators that do exist. Two state lawmakers are not waiting for the courts, and they have introduced legislation requiring the MTA to make every station receiving a major renovation wheelchair accessible. The MTA has said that would increase costs by a tremendous amount. And in more local news, the MTA will remove more than a dozen stops from the M14 bus route as part of its highly contested plan for a select bus service route along 14th Street. That's according to the agency. On Thursday, the MTA said it has decided to remove the local stops in order to introduce speedier cross-town bus service on 14th Street to help travelers during the L train slowdown. The agency also wants to install kiosks so passengers can pay their fares before boarding at any one of three bus doors. The now finalized plan, which is slated to go into effect in June, calls for moving 17 M14 stops and adding one. The plan will take away five fewer stops than initially proposed. The MTA said the bus stops would be 675 feet apart on the Lower East Side. The M14 runs east-west along 14th Street and north-south in the East Village along Avenue A and Avenue D. And last night, a committee of Community Board 3 on the Lower East Side held a contentious meeting to discuss the city's plan to protect Lower Manhattan from sea level rise from caused by storms made worse by climate change. Thousands of residents in NYCHA housing as well as private housing are at threat, but some